It's your Tech Update Monday on the Lee Rayburn Show, and our guest this hour is here to answer your tech questions. I've actually got a little story of success I'd like to share to start, but let me introduce our guest and let you know how you can join us. Beth D'Angelo returns. She has worked in IT for more than 20 years. She's a senior IT specialist at UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology, finding creative solutions to our problems, and you are welcome to join us with your questions and Beth's solutions at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can always send us an email as well, talk@wpr.org. And Beth, welcome back to the show.
Good morning, Lee. Thanks for having me on.
So before we get to the questions, and I just have a story to share. I'm so proud of this one.
Sounds like you had a big win. Let's hear it.
It was not a big win, but you know, one of the chronic problems that comes up on this show is getting our printers to talk to our routers and then have our, you know, computers or laptops be able to print something wirelessly. And I had a friend whose mom's old printer wouldn't talk to her new router, which I think the internet provider made her get the new router to update that, but then the old printer would not connect. So my solution, and it is pretty grand, was to connect the printer to the router using an Ethernet cable. Problem solved.
Bingo.
Like
creative solutions. That's what I'm all about. If you can't get it to work one way, try another.
It doesn't have to be wireless. I think we've gotten so used to everything connected through the air that we forget that we can just connect the cable, and an Ethernet cable between your router and a printer is going to bypass any sort of wireless communication problems you may have.
Yeah, it's a really good way to troubleshoot, you know, what is actually going wrong with the piece of equipment you have, because if you can get it to connect through a wire and it's not connecting wirelessly, then you can rule out a lot of other issues that sounds like they're not talking to each other. So
it wasn't an elegant solution. Yeah, it wasn't a complicated solution. It was just one that I was proud of because I know we've heard the questions on the show before. Why can't my printer connect to my router? And it can.
I would say that usually the least complicated solutions are the most elegant.
I will take that as a victory, and thank you for that, Beth.
Of course.
So let's start today with a new school year, which is either getting underway or about to, and the new gear that kids may be looking for. Now, I'm probably dating myself here, but back in my day, I remember having to get a graphing calculator for math class. Did you ever have to get a graphing calculator?
The old TI-81, the TI-83, or the TI-85. I don't know, depending on how much money you wanted to spend, but
I was going to say, in terms of real money, I think those things were about as expensive as some of the cheaper laptops you could find today.
They weren't cheap, that's for sure. And I remember, you know, having to shell out the bucks for one and protecting it at all costs.
And it was pretty basic considering the things that your laptop can do today. But when it comes to shopping for new gear and depending on how much money you want to spend, what are the things that I should be looking at and what are the things I need to understand, Beth?
Yeah, well, I think that focusing on what you're typical use case for that piece of gear is going to be. What exactly do you think you're going to be doing with it? Are we looking at something you want to take back and forth to school every day? If that's the case, you might want to look at something that's more compact, more lightweight, one of the smaller laptops. There are some great options out there now at a much lower cost than laptops have been historically. So I know Apple has a new product out. Their new, what is it called? The iBook?
I don't remember what it's called.
MacBook Air. That's MacBook Air. There we go.
But its price tag's about $599 or something like that?
Yeah. There's a couple others. So Lenovo's got an IdeaPad, the Slim, that's like, those start around a $300 to $400 range. Mm-hmm. So there are other options outside of Apple that are a little bit lower price point that, are really competing with the price point that used to just be reserved for, something like a Chromebook.
Well, and this gets into use cases, though, because if you are a student, you may need it for writing papers. You may need it for some basic connectivity issues, but I don't know how complicated it needs to be. I don't know how, you know, how many bells and whistles you really would need to have for basic things like taking notes and writing papers.
Yeah, there's some, you know, also tablet options that are available that make a really good, like, portable digital notebook. That's something that I use frequently for note-taking, you know, in meetings or just for keeping all of my various materials in one place. So I think a tablet is a really good idea if you're not looking for a laptop.
Is a tablet something you can type with? Do you need an accessory in order to do that efficiently?
I have a case for my tablet that actually has a keyboard built into it.
Ooh.
So it is an accessory that you need to purchase separately, but it kind of protects the laptop or the tablet and also functions as a wireless keyboard. So it's a nice little feature. I think the one I have was under $100. And so I have basically my iPad is a laptop now with a touchscreen.
Wow. And
yeah.
And that does what you need, and you're with the Division of Information Technology, which means unless you're doing like video editing or something, it's probably about as much as a student would need.
Yeah, really. I use my iPad for a lot of my just daily, you know, workload.
Emails.
I do, yeah, emails, a lot of my personal stuff as well.
Mm-hmm.
But for work, I still use a laptop primarily, but that's because I'm sitting at a desk and I get to work from home, thankfully, so I don't have to move back and forth. But it's really nice to have the portability of the iPad that, you know, I can get up and go sit on my deck and work outside in the sunshine without having to tow a bunch of cables around.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Unless, of course, you need an Ethernet cable to connect your printer. In that case, you wouldn't take your printer outside anyway. Not necessary.
You need a longer cable.
Let's talk about some of the acronyms that you may come across when you are shopping for a new technology. And we can start with the CPU. Now, is that Computer Processing Unit? Is that what it stands for?
Yeah, that's the central processing unit for your motherboard or for your computer. Essentially, it is the hub or the brains of your machine. So not that it stores data, but it processes data. So all of the ones and zeros that happen, all of the data processing happens on a chipset, and that chipset is called the CPU or the central processing unit.
How much have these chipsets evolved over the last few years? I feel like we were getting new CPUs or next generation CPUs every couple of years, but that now feels like it's been a couple of years.
Yeah, I think we've had some issues with the slowing down of the technological advancement of chipsets has a lot to do with supply line issues.
Mm.
There have been a lot of shortages of certain types of chipsets and the smaller like semiconductors that those chipsets function off of. A lot of the metals that are used to create those come from countries that are in conflict zones or are not playing nicely with other governments, or our government is not playing nicely with them currently. So there have been some issues in our trade economy with getting the materials necessary to create a lot of the chips that are needed. So I think there's been less focus on expanding the technology and more focus on production of necessary chipsets for existing technologies.
So would I need the latest CPU or the next most recent generation for most of what I need? Or how far back could I go in terms of finding an affordable CPU?
Yeah, I honestly never buy the bleeding edge of whatever technology is coming out. I usually wait for a generation or two before I invest my money in. Mostly a cost issue, like, the return on investment. If a product is the first generation of something, it's going to have more bugs in the system. There's going to be less time where the issues that newest technology has come out with have had to be reported and worked out, so there aren't going to be as many patches for it. So you're going to get a buggier version of that technology. It's going to cost a much higher initial investment to get in at the ground floor of something new. If you wait 6 months or a year or up to 18 months, there may be one or two new generations of that technology or competition from another player that comes in and lowers that price point, where you're getting a better return on what you're investing in.
And if I'm not mistaken, I think Apple makes their own CPUs, right? And I think Intel, AMD, those are the chip processing or central processing units that I can think of offhand.
Yeah, those are really the three main players. So Apple does make their own M-series processors. So those are what we would call proprietary, meaning they're not farmed out to an external company to manufacture. But then you have Intel, which is a major player in CPUs. And then you have AMD, which is also another large manufacturer of CPUs. And then NVIDIA is a chipset maker. They really got in the game with video card chipsets, so video processors, they are really now the biggest player in the market as far as overall chipset manufacturing. So NVIDIA is kind of the big 800-pound gorilla.
And that would be like GPU, right?
GPUs, yeah, the graphic processing unit. So,
and I wouldn't necessarily think about the strength of a GPU when buying a computer unless, again, I would be doing video editing or maybe some high-end computer games.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, like, the more you're doing graphically, the better GPU or graphics processing unit you're going to want to have in your machine. If you're doing high-end video editing or if you're playing video games that require a faster GPU in order to not have lag in the processing of that video, it's really a good idea to invest in a, you know, better graphics card.
You mentioned some of the supply issues with CPUs. I've also seen supply issues with RAM. I think that's random access memory. Is that correct?
It is, yeah. RAM is really what we call the memory in your computer, that random access memory. That is essentially your computer's ability to multitask at any one time. That's like the amount of processing space that your computer allots for anything to happen live. So any live data that is going through your processor needs to be buffered by an amount of memory. So it's not memory in the sense of data storage in your hard drive. It's memory in the sense of live action on specific data on the hard drive.
So random access memory, I used to think is 8 gigabytes would be good enough, but now it sounds like 16 gigabytes of RAM is pretty much more or less standard.
Yeah, it's really grown over the years. Just the amount of RAM that certain applications require in order to run, the amount of RAM that just your operating system requires to run in the background has increased. So the baseline amount for so let's see, what's the baseline for Windows 11?
It's probably 16.
Let's see, what's the RAM requirements for it? I don't know it offhand. It is a minimum of 4.
Oh.
But that, like, it's, well, but then it says the bare basic minimum for doing anything with it is 8. but anything specialized, like really anything, if you're going to use like Copilot, or any of the AI features within any of the newer software that you're using, you need 32 plus gigs of RAM in order to run that.
32 sounds expensive.
It can get expensive, that's for sure.
James in Wales emailed us. He recently dropped his iPad 10th generation and cracked the actual screen. Do we know how much approximately it costs to replace the screen on an iPad?
I know on an iPhone, it's right around $100.
Oh, that's not bad.
Probably pretty similar. At least that's what it was last I looked into it.
Okay.
That doesn't mean that it's the same in today's economy, you know, with inflation and all that. But it's been a few years since I've needed to do it. Yeah, I would say probably not more than $100 to $150 to do that. Otherwise, people wouldn't really go through the trouble of it.
Right. At a certain point, it begins worthwhile investigating whether it's time to get a new one anyway.
Correct.
Beth D'Angelo, our guest, senior IT specialist for UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. And if you have a tech question, she can handle it at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email, as James in Wales did, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. And when it comes to fixing apples, it's relatively easy. You can just go to the Apple Store, your nearest Apple Store. But when it comes to fixing other tech gear, do you have a recommendation of where you should look to get your stuff fixed?
Yeah, I mean, locally here in Madison, I've always been a big supporter of the shop over on the west side. What is it? Madison Computer Supply.
Mm-hmm.
They are fantastic. I've been using them for 30 years, maybe.
Wow.
They know their stuff. You can basically bring anything to them. They can fix it. If they don't have the parts, they'll help you find it. Awesome place. Outside of Madison, your options are going to be more limited. I would say look to a local shop first before you send something off. If you can bring it into a local repair place, if they can diagnose on site, I believe you're going to get better service from going to a local provider than using like a service where you would mail in your machine to have it fixed and have it sent back to you. There are some of the big box stores that provide that service. I know Geek Squad through Best Buy is an option that people have been using for a long time. I've never personally used them, but also I do most of my hardware work myself. But Madison Computer Works, if I was going to shout out anyone, it would be them.
All right, back to shopping for new electronics. We talked about RAM, random access memory, which is the ability to process the memory used to process things. So if you have like a, you want to do multiple things at once, the more RAM, the better. If you want to do AI, the more RAM, the better. Although there does seem to be some supply issues, and that has driven up some cost considerably. So it's something to think about. But the other thing to think about with this is if you can't afford the RAM right now and want to expand later, the ability to have expansion within, and I don't even know if that's possible with laptops. I know with desktops, it's a little easier to add RAM cards down the road, but do laptops allow for increasing your random access memory at some point?
Yeah, most of them do.
Okay.
Most of them, you can actually, there's a slot you can pop open to take the old RAM card chips out and replace them with new ones. One thing to bear in mind is that you always want to upgrade in equal parts. So if you have, let's say you have 8 gigs of memory in your laptop currently, and that comes on 2 4-gigabyte memory chips, you want to upgrade that, you need to upgrade both of those chips. So you want them to always be in equal parts. So you would want then to get 2 8-gigabyte chips to go up to 16 rather than just upgrading one of them.
Do CPUs or RAM become obsolete at some point, or is that something that you probably don't need to consider because of the likely life of your electronics?
Where they become obsolete is in that they become incompatible with software.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say you had an old processor in an old computer and you wanted to put the latest version of Windows on that computer. If the processor was beyond a certain age where it didn't have compatible technology, that OS would not install on that machine.
Okay.
It being compatible.
I remember trying to save up enough money for a new computer when I wanted to play the game Civilization because it was not compatible with the old computer. That was where my priorities were back in the school days. So, and it took me a while, but it was worth it. All right, so when it comes to memory, the other memory that I can think of is like the hard drive itself, where you actually store stuff. And I wonder, in the age of cloud computing and being able to store stuff in the cloud or online, how important the size of your hard drive is and whether or not that should be a consideration when shopping.
Yeah, I would say it's still a consideration to ensure that you have enough hard drive storage to keep what you want locally. My problem with maintaining everything in the cloud and not keeping any local version of your data is that cloud providers eventually will increase the cost for storage. So while they may give you a small amount for free to start, that fills up quickly, and then suddenly your costs start ballooning and you're paying a monthly subscription fee to store things that you could be keeping on your hard drive at home because they don't necessarily need to be in the cloud. If you have maybe a lot of like old photos that you just want cold storage for that you don't need to keep in the cloud, or anything that may take up a lot of cloud storage space, maybe your music, video collection, something like that. That online storage, that cloud storage, is getting increasingly more expensive every year. And they get you hooked with that little amount for free, or that very low cost initial get started, and then you get you get hooked on it. So again, it's that dope man economics. You know, the dope man economics, the first one's free. And,
you'll pay
and then
after
you gotta
that.
Pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's something to be said for maintaining some local storage for especially like larger files like videos or old photos or music, stuff like that.
So would a terabyte be a start then? And would that be something that you could expand with external hard drives as well down the road if you needed to?
Yeah, a terabyte is a lot of storage.
Okay.
And while it doesn't sound like a lot in our minds now, because like most laptops are coming with like a terabyte as their initial SSD. Mm-hmm. And that can fill up if you're doing a lot of like video, large video files. But that is a lot of storage, and external hard drives are still relatively cheap and very easy to use. They're plug and play now. So if you just need some cold storage, I think that's a really good option.
You said SSD there, another acronym we should probably address. That would be a solid state drive, which is most of these.
Solid state drive.
Yeah. And I don't like the old ones are disks and the HDDs, but I don't know if those are so prevalent anymore as far as I've seen.
Yeah, and generally now, like most machines, at least for the main hard drive, those are coming with SSDs. So the hard drive that your operating system is installed on is going to be generally on an SSD now because those drives have faster input output.
Yeah.
So much faster throughput, and it takes less time for them to spin up because it's not disk based. There's actually no moving parts. A solid state drive is actually really similar to RAM. It's just like a very large chunk of RAM, essentially.
And with the lack of moving parts, I would imagine that that might make the life cycle for a solid state drive a little bit more secure than the old fashioned disks.
Yeah, less likely to have any like mechanical breakdown because there's no moving pieces inside of it.
Beth, where would I look to begin shopping? Do you have any recommendations where I would go to begin looking for the best deals on what I need?
I am a huge fan of Backmarket. If you haven't checked it out, that's B-A-C-K, Backmarket. It's like a electronics secondhand, I guess, reseller. Overstock, new, used. I've purchased electronics through them. I'm also a big fan of Newegg. If you've ever used Newegg, they're an online reseller of electronics. I've been purchasing gear from them for 30 years.
So you're good with buying secondhand computer gear?
Or like aftermarket, not being sold by like a large distributor. So
okay.
Because I think there is a lot to be said for the online review system in especially a platform like Backmarket that is really good about vetting the online review process.
Sure.
So you're actually, I think, getting a better transparency into the seller than you would buying from, a Best Buy or an Office Max or any large chain store that, I really haven't had a lot of great luck with customer service with large chain stores. But if I can look and see that the reviews for this seller are pretty well regarded, I think I'm more so going to trust that.
Newegg I was familiar with. Backmarket is new to me. And the next time my shopping comes for electronics, I will be sure to start there to see what I can find.
Especially if you're looking for refurbished products. They've got, if you want an iPhone that's a couple of generations back, I would trust their refurbishment process 100%.
And you would probably be saving hundreds of dollars compared to the newest models.
Yeah, absolutely. I've also bought a lot of electronics off of eBay, surprisingly. I've had very good luck on eBay. You just really have to vet the sellers. You have to look at their selling history. You have to look at what they've been selling, how many they've sold, what reviews they have, how long they've been selling, those kinds of things. And if they look like a reputable seller, give them a try.
Beth D'Angelo, our guest. It's our Tech Day today, and you're welcome to the conversation with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Beth's a senior IT specialist at UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. You can also send us an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to WPR News. All right, we've covered the technology basics. Let's get to your questions now for our guest, Beth D'Angelo. She's got more than 20 years of experience working in IT. She is now the Senior Information Technology Specialist at UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. And she can help solve your problems at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And we'll start with Carolyn DePere. Carol, hi.
Taking my call. I wanted to ask, I use VoiceOver on an Apple product because I'm blind and I can't see the screen. So I'm going through a lot of battery all the time. And I use also the alarms for morning wake up. I don't turn VoiceOver off overnight, but I'm wondering if that would help me save some battery.
And when you say you're using an Apple, is this a phone, a tablet? What are you using?
A phone. Oh, it's a phone.
So you're using iPhone with a VoiceOver compatibility, and you're losing a lot of battery. Beth, what can Carol do?
Yeah, Carol, that's absolutely, the VoiceOver feature can drain your battery because it's constantly listening for voice activation in order to use those prompts to access functions on your phone. So a couple things that you can do to reduce the impact on your battery. One is obviously to turn it off when you're not using it. So if you can turn it off overnight, that would definitely use less of your battery during that time. If it's a problem to actually toggle it on and off for you, you can set up a shortcut in the accessibility settings so that if, say, you're using a newer iPhone, it's got that side button. You could do like a triple click to turn on and off that VoiceOver feature.
Oh,
so it's really easy for you to turn it on and off. So if you just go into the settings and then the accessibility settings, you want to create what's called an accessibility shortcut. And that'll allow you to select VoiceOver for that shortcut.
That would be an easy
way
to turn it off and on, Carol, and I hope that helps. Would that have any impact on Carol's alarm in the morning?
Yeah, I'm not. I didn't hear the second part about the alarm. Can you repeat that?
Oh, well, I'm using the phone also as my wake-up alarm. And that's not the voice, you know, it's no VoiceOver comment. Mm-hmm. When the alarm rings, it's just alarm. So
yeah, I don't think that would
interfere. Yeah, I don't think just keeping the alarm function leaving the alarm function enabled, it shouldn't drain your battery at all. That's not going to use much. It's really that the VoiceOver feature is keeping your microphone constantly engaged to listen for those commands, and that's eating up your battery life. So if you could turn that off when you go to bed, if it doesn't need to listen for you, and then easily just do that three clicks on the side button to turn it back on, that would really save a lot of battery life for you, I think.
So you'd have to create that shortcut, Carol, but once you do, it should make things a lot easier for you. And thank you so much for calling. Beth, I have a Google Pixel phone that just drains my battery constantly, and I have looked for solutions, and it turns out that the solution may just be turning on Battery Saver. Now, I don't know if Battery Saver would interfere with Carol's VoiceOver controls, but that Battery Saver has certainly saved me a lot of time from plugging my phone back in.
Yeah, I think on an Apple it's called the low power mode, and I'm not sure if that interferes with VoiceOver.
It might, because it would sound like something that, it could interfere with some apps, but when it comes to accessibility, maybe there's an allowance for that. But it just seems to keep Google from doing all its processing, thinking, and communicating that is not necessary for me to use my phone, and it saved me a lot of battery life.
Yeah, I think it doesn't look like it. I don't think the low power mode turns the VoiceOver function off.
So that might be another option for you, Carol, the low power mode on your iPhone. And thank you again for calling. Let's go to Ann and Madison next. Ann, hi.
Hi. I am shortly going to be shopping for a new phone. I currently have an Android. Is there a reason I should go to the iPhone over the Android?
Good question.
Do you like the Android?
I do, but I have a lot of siblings or younger people. Oh, you need an iPhone. It's so much easier, blah, blah, blah.
Easier for them, maybe. You know, honestly, the couple of reasons why I would switch to an iPhone over an Android if I were used to using an Android and that's what I was comfortable with would be if I am looking to use more Apple products like an Apple Watch and an iPad, and if I was really tied to certain Apple software products, I would then think about getting all of my electronics on one ecosystem, so moving everything into the Apple universe. What that does is it, if you say you switch to an iPhone and you're texting with your friends, it gives you the ability to use iMessage rather than SMS messaging, which really all that does is it gives you the three dots when somebody is chatting you and the message hasn't been sent yet, and maybe it makes group messaging a little bit less clunky. It also allows you to use the, like, Find My iPhone feature so you can, like, share your location with people, which I don't know why you would want to do that. So honestly, I don't know that there's a reason other than, you know, yeah, there's not much advantage.
Well,
it's more expensive.
If you want to spend more money, but I will say, Anne, I do have, my younger sisters with their iPhones and their text messages are always bugging me to get an iPhone because text messaging for them is easier. As Beth explained, you can see the dots when they're typing and I don't necessarily want them to see that I'm typing. I want them to see the message after I send it. What if I decide not to send it? Then they'd wonder what I was typing and never sent. There are some, there's some questions there.
I feel like you could be more incognito on an Android or, you know, a Google phone than you can on an iPhone. Like on an iPhone, everybody knows your business. So.
Especially if they have Apple products as well. It's like you're in that universe.
Yeah, Apple just wants to broadcast your business to everyone. So.
Well, I thought
don't do it.
Their whole ad campaign was being the privacy ones. They're the ones that keep your information locked down. Unless, of course, you
security
choose.
Security through obscurity.
And great question. And I think the answer is if you like your Android, there's no reason not to stick with it. If you would like to enter the Apple universe, their software and their other products, then you might want to consider switching, although it may cost you a little more money. Does that sound about right, Beth?
Yep.
All right. Thank you for calling, Ann. We'll go to Dwayne in Westfield next. Hi, Dwayne.
Hey, good morning. How you doing? Love the show.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I was wondering, I had a question. Now, I have a personal opinion on it, but what is your on the brand new Nokia brand's phones coming out? Most of them are going to be under 30 minutes to charge from 0 to 100%. Most of them will have a glass tip, or they call it a diamond tip. If it drops, it will break. And also has a stronger processor and everything else. What's your opinion on those?
Nokia's new phones, which is weird, Dwayne, because my very first cell phone back in the day was a Nokia. So are Nokias making a comeback, Beth? Have you seen them? And if so, what do you know?
They are, and it is not the Nokia 5150 that we all had way back in the day.
I remember the ringtone.
That thing was a workhorse. I'll tell you, I've never had a better cell phone than that Nokia. You could drop it out of a moving car, and it would be just fine. It was a brick, that's for sure. So, yeah, there's two new phones that Nokia has just dropped in 2026, the 215 and the 25. I don't know a whole lot about them. They're 4G phones, not 5G phones. So they're connecting on an older, network. So they may not have the throughput speeds of the newer 5G phones, but that may be why the prices are lower. They do have some pretty intricate AI integration, in them. So, here's one. A controversial dedicated AI button and chat applications for digital detox users.
Oh.
I have no idea what that means. So you could just, like, talk to your phone instead of, like, looking at it. Oh, that's interesting.
What would be the pros and cons of getting a 4G phone in a 5G universe? It sounds like that might be a step back or might be inhibiting in some way, or is it?
Yeah, I think it may just be... I think more leaning into like the dumb phone aspect of technology, you know, where folks are not looking to have the all of your apps and your whole world on your phone, to basically just have a phone with the ability to do some of those things, but not like the addicting features of the, you know, the touchscreen technology and, you know, bright colors and flashing lights on your screen all the time. So I think it's kind of a bit of a throwback to a little bit more nostalgic technology, and this nod to folks looking for more dumb phones.
So you might not be able to play Candy Crush on it, and that might be exactly what you're looking for, Dwayne.
Yeah. They also have a cool power bank that looks like the old Nokia brick phones called the Nokia 300 Charge.
Well, I would say the more cell phones in the market, the more competition and the better for the consumer. So, yeah, I'd price them out. And if the 4G network works for you, Dwayne, that might be a solution going forward. And if you want to... you know, a phone with less bells and whistles, that may be your best bet. And now I'm kind of curious because of my fondness for the first cell phone I ever had. So thank you for calling. We'll go to Patrick in Fitchburg next. Patrick, hi.
Hi. Yes, thank you for taking my call. I have a couple of questions. One, I'd like to know where I can get a refurbished laptop. In good working order. I think your guest mentioned it earlier, but I missed it.
Mm-hmm.
Then two, I have a laptop, MacBook Air laptop, that I bought, I believe, in 2008, 2009. It still works, but it has some missing features, and I believe it's now outdated. And if I need to, I want to upgrade it, but do I need a brand new laptop, or I can have some of those outdated features just upgraded at a refurbished store? That's two. Then number three, my laptop, I mean my iPad answers phones, or when my business number rings, it rings through my iPad, and when I try to answer it through my phone, it doesn't go through. I cannot answer it through my phone. Is there a way I can be able to answer it through my phone?
Patrick, thank you. Some good questions there. Let's start with the iPad and not being able to answer his business number over his phone, Beth.
Yeah, that is just likely a setting. Within the settings on either the iPad or on your, if you have an iPhone that you're trying to answer on, you need to go into the Apple ID setting. And I think there's a way to, it'll show your phone number, and you need to enable the devices that phone number is capable of being reached on. So it'll give a list of the devices that that phone number will ring to, and you need to make sure that your iPhone is on that list and that it's selected.
When it comes to a MacBook from 2008 or 2009, is Patrick out of luck on updating, or is there something he can do to keep that alive a little bit longer?
Yeah, that's probably going to be not worth updating. I don't know that you'll be able to do much with it. It's probably too old to put any of the newer operating systems on if you wanted to update the software. Likely there isn't hardware that you could put into it that would make it compatible with the newer operating systems. I think it's probably lived its useful lifespan. If it's, you know, 16, 17 years old, that's a pretty good run,
yeah.
And I'd retire it.
I'd also think about it might be a museum worthy down the road, Patrick, because after a while, something that old becomes kind of a keepsake, and folks might want something like that, like some of the original MacBooks or iMacs or whatever. Those things became kind of collector's items after a while.
Yeah, it's not old. It's a classic.
Absolutely. And then the final question for Patrick. Sergio also emailed to ask the same. Can you please repeat the used electronics website that you recommend?
Yes, it is Back Market, BACK Market.
Back Market would be a place to start. Patrick, thank you for the call. Sergio, thank you for the email. Our guest, Beth D'Angelo, Senior IT Specialist at UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. And we'll go to Nick in Green Bay next. Hi, Nick.
Hey, I've got a question for you.
Yeah.
I'm a licensed amateur radio operator, so I know about electronics. So this makes me really upset. I got the iPhone Pro 16 Max, and I've had it for a while, and I cannot get the battery to extend. I shut everything off in the background, and I still can't get the battery to last more than a day. Like, after I get off the phone with you, I'll have to recharge it. And I usually charge it at night when I'm sleeping, so it's fully charged in the morning, and I can't make it until 5 o'clock tonight.
How old is this?
I've had it like two or three years, and it's not like the old days where you could zap the battery for the crystals on the battery, so I don't know what to do with it. And
yeah,
like I said, I've shut everything down. I've scanned it with scanners and stuff, and nothing seems to help. And the only thing I really use a phone for besides phone calls is like amateur radio programs, like, you know, apps for that.
Yeah.
And so,
Yeah, that's frustrating, Nick. Beth, what can he do?
Yeah, the things that I would recommend, and you mentioned some of these that you went through already, is obviously going into the settings and then the battery settings to see if there are any rogue apps that are running. Turn off the background app refresh for any of those apps. You can lower your screen brightness. I know that that can really impact your battery life. Turning off location services or restricting those as much as possible. And then also just making sure you have the latest like version of iOS on there installed, just in case there are any like battery life patches that are in that update.
It's just a couple years old. Is it possible that Nick got a lemon when it comes to a bad battery?
You know, it is possible. Like, batteries do develop dead spots or can possibly come from the manufacturer with dead spots within them, which means, you know, if a cell within that battery won't take a charge, then your battery only ever really charges to, like, 75%. Even though it's reporting 100% charge on the indicator, only 3 out of 4 of those cells would actually hold a charge. And the only way to tell that is for somebody to actually go into the phone and put a battery tester, a multimeter, onto those battery connections to see if it's generating power. So if it's still under warranty, I would recommend taking it in to the Apple store and having them take a look at it.
Even if it's not under warranty, you might want to make an appointment with them and see if there is something structurally deficient about this battery, because that does not sound right, Nick. And thank you for calling. Here's one for you, Beth. Bob emailed us about a Wi-Fi problem. He has a router upstairs to boost the signal from the phone company's router in the basement. His new Windows 11 laptop sees a strong 5G signal from the router in the basement, but only a weak 2.4G signal from the router sitting just 2 feet from it, and no 5G from that upstairs router at all. The upstairs router is indeed capable of 5G and 2.4G. His old Windows 10 laptop can see a strong signal from both routers. He's also trying to move files from the old computer to the new one over his home Wi-Fi network, but the new Windows 11 doesn't see the old Windows 10, even if they are both on the same Wi-Fi signal. And he says there's no Ethernet connection on the new laptop, which I've seen in a lot of these. They don't have the ports that you would expect in some of the old ones. So what can Bob do next?
Yeah, interesting. So the new laptop may not see the old laptop due to permissions. If the old laptop, you know, in any way isn't set up on your home network to be seen by other devices, that may be why you're not seeing it when you're connected to the same network. But as far as seeing different signal strengths with different machines, I would chalk that up to what's called the network interface card, or the NIC, in your different devices. It sounds like one of them is not behaving as expected, and it's really not catching that dual band Wi-Fi properly. So I would go into the settings of the network interface card and make sure that it's configured in a way to connect with your Wi-Fi router so that they're not conflicting with each other. So if you have the Wi-Fi router set up to dual band, you need that network interface card on your machine to be set up to dual band as well.
Bob, it sounds a little bit complicated. And when he's got the new Windows 11 laptop seeing a strong 5G signal from the router in the basement, but only a weak 2.4G signal from the router sitting 2 feet from it, no 5G from that whatsoever, makes me think it might be the new computer more than the old one.
Yeah, it sounds like some wonky settings on the network interface card on that new laptop.
We'll go to Rich in Appleton next. Rich, hi.
Yeah, it sounds like some wonky settings on the network interface card.
Oh, hey, it's Beth again. Rich. Rich, are you?
Rich in Appleton next. Rich,
That's Rich.
No. Yeah, it sounds like some wonky settings.
All right, I'm sorry we couldn't get you, Rich. I got Karen in Bailey's Harbor who's got an email for you that I think can apply to all of us. It asks about the risks and benefits of setting up a passkey for accounts. She's getting prompted to do this routinely and wondering if limitations exist. We've talked about passkeys in the past, but I'm also feel like the prompt is a red flag. So what should Karen do here? Beth?
Sorry, I was on mute because of the reverb that we had happening before. I didn't want to make it worse.
Thank you.
I was trying to help. I made it worse again. So really, like, the advantage of a passkey over, let's say, like, keeping passwords is a passkey, like, replaces that traditional password with, like, a single cryptographic key that's based on either, like, a biometric, so a thumbprint or face reader or something like that, or a PIN number for a fast login so that you don't have to put in a password every time you're logging into something. So anybody who's using like an iPhone and has a thumbprint or the facial recognition feature turned on is using a passkey for access to their device. So, you know, there are some benefits as far as how quick it is to get in. So they only, like, work in the exact, like, instance or application that they're registered to. So it reduces the chance of what we call phishing or login for, like a fake login. So that's helpful. It's simpler than remembering things like passwords for various websites. And you also don't have, like, the reuse risk that you have with passwords. If you're reusing passwords across multiple sites, you don't have that risk either with password being being leaked or compromised.
I sometimes get suspicious when I'm prompted to do something. I generally think if I want to do something, I'll prompt myself to do it. And if something's prompted me to it, sometimes it raises a red flag. But with a passkey, that's probably – maybe that's not an issue here, that it's not a red flag for you, Beth.
Well, the nice thing is you can, if you see suspicious activity with a passkey, you can immediately revoke it.
Okay.
And that, like, triggers an account recovery process that requires some other method of authentication for you to get that active again. So it's a lot easier to disable a passkey in that sense.
Do you use passkeys?
I do.
Okay.
I use them for lots of things.
And so Karen in Bailey's Harbor could probably go ahead and give it a try on a few things and see how it works for her and then move forward with that, or try it on one thing and see if it works for her and then move forward with that.
Yeah, maybe not start off with your bank account or your health information system, but you want to start with something small and then build your trust in the system. I think that's a good way to go.
Beth, I feel like we've done a lot of work here today.
Good work.
It was
good work, Lee.
I mean, we started with my simple little Ethernet cable solution, and then you took it from there, and I feel like we've solved at least the tech problems for the next few weeks, and then we'll just have to have you back again, and we'll see what we can solve next time. So I thank you, as always.
Simple yet elegant. Simple yet elegantly. Don't forget the elegant part.
That is kind of key. And as the problems crop up with your technology, take note, write them down, and then join us on these Mondays when we have an hour with our tech experts, and we can help solve them for you. Beth D'Angelo, thanks again.
Thanks, Lee.
Beth is a senior IT specialist of UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology, and simple and elegant solutions for you on Mondays for our Tech Mondays. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to WPR News.